At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
How banks are navigating a cooling economy, and how schools, and the rest of us, are dealing with a warming climate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, July 18th. Good to have you along. As we mentioned last week, banks and corporations have been issuing their second quarter earnings. And those reports, yes, tell us how the companies are doing, but also give us an indication of how the broader economy is doing. This morning, Goldman Sachs said profits fell almost 50% compared to last year, thanks in part to a slowdown in corporate deal-making, which helped push down profits at Bank of America, too. At the same time, banks are reporting consumer and business lending has been growing over the past year. We asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to look into what all that's telling us about the economy right now.
The big reason consumers have been borrowing more is because they've been spending more on their credit cards.
I mean, it's still full steam ahead, I think, from a credit perspective.
That's Andrew Davidson with Comper Media. He says people are also taking out personal loans and using buy now, pay later services.
You have this intensely competitive environment in which consumers have more access to credit than ever.
Meanwhile, corporate borrowing has been growing at the fastest pace in nearly 15 years, says Mike Mayo, bank analyst with Wells Fargo Securities. He says that's in part because businesses have been trying to build up their inventories.
You're also seeing more expansion of businesses, and that was placed on hold to some degree during the pandemic.
Many business owners have been taking out loans because they're worried that if they wait, those loans will get too expensive, says Karen Kerrigan, CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council.
I mean, the cost of capital is only going to increase as rates go higher, as the Fed, you know, makes additional moves.
Kerrigan says the uptick in business borrowing could also be a sign that businesses want cash on hand to help them through a downturn. In fact, banks themselves say they're setting aside more money in case borrowers default on their loans. Nate Tobik is the founder of Complete Bank Data.
It is better to be the concerned banker at the beginning and save up too much versus waiting too late to recognize the losses.
But Mike Mayo with Wells Fargo Securities says banks aren't setting aside nearly as much in reserves as they did at the start of the pandemic.
Then you were looking at unemployment rates that might approach 15%. Now unemployment's under 4%, and maybe it goes up some, but it's night and day versus the pandemic.
And right now, Mayo says, borrowers' finances are healthy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the same concerns those banks have worried the markets a bit as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, moving on from those healthy finances Justin was talking about to the downright unhealthy weather across much of the country and in many parts of the world right now. In the UK, people are bracing for some of the hottest temperatures in recorded history. Dangerous levels of heat are expected in parts of the US today as well. Schools around the country are preparing to deal with these ongoing and worsening effects of global warming. High temperatures, yes, but also more flooding. A 2017 study by Pew found thousands of schools are in areas subject to flooding. And when they do flood, it can cost millions to rebuild. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
School had been in session only a few weeks when intense rain hit on a Saturday last August in Humphreys County in rural Tennessee. Christy Brown works for the school system there and said it was like a tsunami.
I think the official number was right around 21 inches of rain in a matter of several hours. Basically, there was just nowhere for that water to go.
So that water flooded buildings, including an elementary school and a junior high school, which were destroyed. Brown says more than 20 people died in the flooding, including three students. And if it had happened during the school week, more lives would have been lost. So now they're planning to rebuild, but they don't want to do it in a floodplain.
The biggest challenges for us would be finding suitable spaces, because everyone here is needing those same spaces.
Brown says they're retrofitting an old Acme boot factory as a temporary school. Businesses and low-income housing were also destroyed, so land not likely to flood is at a premium. Brown says some of the cost was covered by insurance, and they're receiving money from FEMA in the state of Tennessee. But part of the cost will be borne by the community, too, says Matt Casal with the Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG.
Having to rebuild or repurchase all kinds of supplies after a flood is really impactful and would set a school back.
As schools rebuild, there is an opportunity to get ahead of future natural disasters using solar panels and microgrids to provide power, says Laura Schifter with the Aspen Institute.
People within that community can go to the school. They can access emergency services. They can access power when they need it.
Schifter points out many communities have a school, so it makes sense to invest in them as hubs as the climate continues to change. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
In addition to the heat, many parts of the country are also experiencing drought. In the West, there are generally two schools of thought on how to deal with this. Either use less drinking water than normal to conserve it, or make more of it. A few cities in LA County are doing both, and that has spared them from some of the more stringent drought restrictions so far. Here's KCRW's Kaylee Wells.
Santa Monica's water resources manager, Sunny Wang, is standing at a water treatment plant a block from the ocean. It can process 500,000 gallons of water runoff every day on rainy days. But since rain is a little sparse these days, Wang says the city decided to start using salt water, too.
We also installed a saline infiltration gallery over on the other side of the pier to fully utilize the treatment capacity here when stormwater and urban runoff isn't that available.
In 2013, half of Santa Monica's water was imported. By next year, it'll be just 10%. Some of the drought restrictions in Southern California target water districts that import most of their water from Northern California. That used to include Santa Monica, until recently.
But that doesn't mean we're just sitting around doing nothing. We're looking at increasing our conservation efforts.
And there's more good news. Local water is cheaper than imported water. Wang says Santa Monica water bills are 20 to 40% lower than nearby cities.
10, 20, 30 years out, we're going to be way under the import of water costs historically.
Why isn't every city doing this? Well, Seaside Santa Monica has great access to saline water, namely the ocean. And yes, the ratepayers will pay back the loans used on the more than $200 million investment, but the relatively affluent city's water agency had the money up front. So for Santa Monica, more local water is helpful to have. For another spot in LA County, it's all they have. The roughly 4,000 people living on touristy Catalina Island are so remote that importing water isn't an option. At one time, if the local reservoir ran out, there was no plan B. The mayor of the island city of Avalon, Annie Marshall, has lived on Catalina for 37 years. She says in the last drought, the reservoir was about 11% full.
and most of us don't have yards. So basically, we sacrificed by reducing our personal water consumption by 40%.
Marshall used to stand over a bucket when she showered to water her plants, and she did fewer loads of laundry.
Well, now the tables have kind of turned. I feel so bad for the state of California, but I'm very happy for Catalina Island, is we have two desal plants.
The desalination plants turn about 250,000 gallons of salt water into fresh water each day, which is about 40% of the island's potable water demand. Brian Leventhal works for the plant's operator, Southern California Edison.
Before we relied heavily on desal, Catalina used to be the first in going into drought restrictions. Now that we rely so heavily on desal production, we're at the back of the pack.
On top of that, most of the toilets on Catalina are salt water. Some of the fire hydrants spit out salt water. Southern California Edison is also working on adding another salt water well to make more water at the plants.
It's completely drought resistant, as opposed to groundwater resources, which require rain.
The downside is desalination is one of the more costly ways to get fresh water. But Marshall says expensive water is better than no water at all.
We're all tickled to death that we have it, or we would be looking at what the rest of the state is looking at.
The rest of the state is looking at worsening drought restrictions as the hot, dry summer drags on. The state has already banned watering decorative grass at businesses and subdivision common areas. State leaders say if residents don't cut back, more restrictions could be on the horizon. In Los Angeles, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
New numbers out this morning about the state of the housing market, which is really feeling the impact of those recent Federal Reserve rate hikes. The latest monthly survey from the National Association of Home Builders shows confidence among those home builders is plunging. July saw the largest decline in the nearly four-decade history of the index, with the exception of the early days of the pandemic. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more on what has home builders so worried.
Rising material costs, a supply chain mess, and a labor shortage. Those are the big challenges Birmingham, Alabama home builder Alicia Huey says she was already up against.
We're living every day trying to keep our head above water because it takes so much longer to build a house these days.
Huey, who's also NAHB's first vice chair, says with Fed rate hikes pushing mortgage rates higher,
that has kept a lot of people out of the market.
The NAHB survey shows 13% of builders reported cutting prices to help encourage sales. As the housing market sees signs of softening, some builders are considering putting projects on the rental market. And the U.S. needs more affordable rentals, says Barbara Fields, a vice president at Apt Associates.
We simply, since the last recession, have not gotten up to building at the level we need to be.
About 10% of single-family home building is dedicated towards rentals, says NAHB chief economist Robert Dietz.
Whether that's the builder holding the home and renting it or selling it to an investor, that's about triple the historical market share. And we expect that part of the industry to grow as interest rates remain elevated.
And the inventory of homes for sale is also on the rise, says Bill McBride, who analyzes local housing data for his blog Calculated Risk.
It's really going to impact the housing market. We're going to see areas with price declines.
Likely in markets that have seen some of the steepest price increases during the pandemic. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So it's a common problem, unfortunately.
But what's the solution? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 215 points, about 0.7%, to end at 31,072. The NASDAQ dipped 92 points, 0.8%, to close at 11,360. And the S&P 500 was off 32 points, again about 0.8%, to finish at 3830.
Justin Ho reported that banks are seeing higher loan balances. Goldman Sachs added 2.5% as it reported better than expected earnings and revenue. Bank of America rose just a tad. In a sweltering Europe, markets closed higher. Britain's FTSE and France's CAC 40 stepped up 0.9%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. This weekend, we got more horrific details of just what happened during the deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. The 77-page report out from the Texas House highlights systemic failures like inadequate security at the school and confusion over who was supposed to be in charge. That mass shooting, along with those in Buffalo and elsewhere, prompted the recent passage of the first new law addressing gun violence in decades. But much of what's in that law is actually about mental health. Victoria Knight, who covers health policy in Congress at Kaiser Health News, has been looking at this. Hi, Victoria. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
This bill does have provisions to help combat gun violence, but almost all of the money in it goes towards mental health. Why is that?
That's basically because of a dynamic set up in the Senate, which was that Republicans said they would only agree to having some kind of gun reform legislation if it was also packaged with mental health funding. And Democrats, they said, okay, we're okay with that. We want more funding for mental health. And if that is the way to get you guys to agree to some gun reform, then we'll do it. And that's kind of how it happened. But I will say that mental health advocates, they feel conflicted that it was packaged with the gun reform legislation right beside it, all in one bill, because it does, I think, especially to the American public, kind of give a message that these two things are related when really research shows that people with mental health disorders are not violent. Only 3% to 5% of violent acts are committed by people with serious mental illnesses. It's very, very low number. But packaging them together does continue to perpetuate the idea that gun violence and mental illness are related.
So what exactly is in this particular law in terms of mental health?
So there is a lot in terms of mental health. The total bill cost is $13 billion. Most of that is going towards mental health funding. So a really big chunk, $1 billion, is going to amp up the number of mental health counselors in schools. Then another really, really large chunk, $8.6 billion, is for the build out of something called certified community behavioral health clinics. And right now, those clinics are set up in 10 states. They were done through a pilot Medicaid program, but this bill would allow that to expand to all states if states want to do it. Basically, these are clinics where anyone who is experiencing a mental health crisis can show up and get treatment, no matter whether they have health insurance. And they've been shown to have some success in the states that they already exist in. And one notable thing that mental health advocates were really excited about is $150 million being allocated for the new 988 suicide prevention hotline, which actually rolled out this past weekend.
When can people expect to see or experience expanded access to mental health care as a result of some of the things coming out of this new law?
There is funding allocated this year, such as the 988 Suicide Prevention Lifeline. But for some of the other programs, funding doesn't start until next year or 2024, such as for the certified community behavioral health clinics. So there will be a delay in some of those programs. And I do think people wonder, well, what are we going to do in the meantime until this funding starts? And that's a real question.
What's the general consensus about how much this law will actually do to reduce gun violence in this country?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure we will know the answer. a lot of these programs are not necessarily evaluated for how effective they are, but there's a consensus that it will likely reduce the number of deaths by suicide. And that is because in this bill, there is the ability for states to implement red flag laws. These laws allow for a family member, a friend, sometimes a doctor, depending on the state, to petition a court and ask for a gun to be taken away from someone who they believe is at risk of harming themselves or harming others. And those laws have been shown to reduce deaths by suicide.
And a big chunk of overall gun deaths in this country, for sure.
Yes, over 50% of suicides are done by a gun.
Victoria Knight is a health policy and Congress reporter with Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lots of things about this economy have changed in the pandemic. Many businesses went from temporary shutdowns to permanent closures. Despite growing need, some of them are hospitals. Closures of rural hospitals in particular only accelerated during the pandemic. And some will have a harder time than others attempting a comeback. Among them, hospitals run by companies in the lab business that left behind difficult financial and legal problems. Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville reports.
The hospital in Linden, Tennessee, served Perry County's population of 8,000 up until it abruptly shut down in late 2020. Shelley Sharp was a nurse there.
They came in and they said the hospital would be closing, and the next day or two they closed it.
The hospital was in serious financial trouble. The state's dominant private insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, says the hospital was overcharging for lab tests and demanded nearly $5 million back. The common thread intertwining Perry Community Hospital's fate with at least a dozen closed rural hospitals nationwide is lab testing.
It's running samples.
Michael Perkinson is screening vials of blood for glucose, electrolytes, and lipids. Perkinson is a lab technician who took a job at a nearby clinic when the hospital shut down. He says the trouble seemed to start in mid-2018 with a new owner from Florida. The hospital started buying fancier lab equipment, and samples began streaming in from out of state.
We did a lot of drug screens out of Florida. Thus the problem.
Some small rural hospitals are allowed to charge more for lab work than freestanding labs. It's an arrangement intended to help prop up hospitals in remote areas. But at Perry Community, Blue Cross Blue Shield said an audit found improper billing codes and charges for people who'd never been patients at the hospital. And an arbitration panel recently sided with Blue Cross, which has been challenging similar schemes across the region.
So it's a common problem, unfortunately.
The lone hospital in a neighboring county also came under investigation for inflated lab billing before closing. Another Florida lab company snapped up three hospitals in East Tennessee, two of which are now closed. And in 18 rural hospitals across the Midwest, Florida businessman Jorge Perez was just convicted in a $1.4 billion fraud related to lab billing. Eight of those hospitals shut down. Accountant Paul Trasick of Whipfley helps investors decide if these shuttered hospitals can profitably reopen. He says the problem is that insurance companies may not work with a new owner until the disputed payments are settled.
Really, it's determining, you know, is that liability, are you sort of stuck with it? Because if you are, no matter what you do, it may not work.
And that's on top of untangling other legal concerns, like who still controls the hospital. In Linden, Tennessee, yet another Florida lab company, Expertus, bought the hospital just months before it closed. Now, Linden's mayor has gotten involved in trying to find a new buyer. Mayor Wes Ward has even shown a few investors around.
Not even sure how the door got unlocked, to be honest with you.
Ward has been under intense political pressure to find a way to reopen the hospital, since the closest emergency room is now 45 minutes away. Residents worry about what happens when someone has a stroke, and drive time makes a difference.
You're talking about the peace of mind for your citizens, that they have a hospital 2 minutes down the road.
Then there are the economics. New industrial employers or even retirees are hesitant to relocate when there's no ER, and hospitals are big employers on their own.
You're talking 120 jobs in this community, that's a lot.
Some promising news comes through while we're talking in the town boardroom.
Hey, Wes, how are you?
All right, how y'all doing?
A group of investors from New Jersey calls to say they're on track to take over this summer.
Hey, I'm tickled to death, y'all.
Ward says the prospective buyers also happen to be in the lab business, but he has more confidence in this group. It includes some doctors. Still, he says he plans to keep a closer eye on the hospital from now on. In Linden, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Stephanie Hughes was talking about the impact of climate change earlier. With these rising temperatures, air conditioning isn't as common in some parts of the world as it is here. For example, in the UK, where they have some creative solutions to help keep people cool. The Washington Post has a story about a chain of movie theaters, Showcase Cinemas, that's offering free tickets for redheads today and tomorrow. Since, as the company explained in a press release, redheads are often more vulnerable than most to the sun's rays. So, at least for a couple of days, they get free access to AC and a movie. Here's your moment of economic context. Lily was talking earlier how American home builders are less than confident about the housing market. Well, foreign home buyers seem to be okay. The National Association of Realtors says those buyers spent $59 billion on residential real estate during the year ending in March. That's up 8.5% from the previous year. Although foreign buyers made up a smaller overall share of the market, because as many of you know, houses have been a little pricey lately. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.